Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Hey there. Welcome to another episode of The Shocking Details. I am Joe, joined as always by...
I'm fairly sure I'm Vincent Caldoni.
You were last time I checked. Okay, good. All right, well, let's talk about a story. This is a story about a bank heist that happened a while back. And
it's a good one.
It's a pretty good one. Yeah, it is. You might have thought that we would have covered all the good ones when we did Heistapalooza a while back.
Yeah.
No, there's still some good ones out there. I've got another couple, actually, two of them, that are in my files that we will talk about one of these days. But this is one that you dug up, Vincent. So you want to give us a little intro to this whole thing?
It's a pleasant evening in September of 1971. Robert Rollins is in his London flat. Rollins is a radio operator.
Like a ham radio operator kind of guy?
I think he did ham, but I don't believe he's on a ham radio. He's on a wide frequency radio.
Mm.
But he had a bunch of different towers up on his apartment building's roof, so I don't totally know what he's doing. What he's looking for is he's looking to tune into a Belgian radio station, FM radio, but not one you would normally get on your radio in London, right? It's got this giant antenna. And over this antenna, he starts to hear something he was not expecting. It's walkie-talkie chat, but it isn't on the usual frequencies you'd expect to be hearing a walkie-talkie. And the people on the channel are speaking in some kind of code. And he can't be certain, but it definitely sounds like they're up to no good, probably something criminal. So after listening for about like half an hour, Rollins decides he needs to call the cops. It sounds shady.
Yeah.
But the officer who picks up, he's pretty dismissive. He just doesn't seem worried at all. Mm. And so probably just to get Rollins off his back, he suggests that Rollins tape record the conversations. Mm. And I doubt this cop expected anything to come of it. But Rollins, however, he is worried. You see, for his radio to pick up this signal, and I don't understand all the dynamics with radios, but for him to be getting this, it has to be local, just within a few kilometers. So he takes out an educational cassette he's been using to learn Spanish, and he starts taping over.
Yeah, that much for learning Spanish, I guess.
Yeah, right. There goes your Spanish lesson. He didn't have a blank tape. He didn't, from what I can tell about Rollins, is he didn't tend to actually record stuff off the radio like some people did back then. The more he hears, the more clear a picture he starts to get. The people on the radio are definitely arguing with a lookout. And something has filled the area they are in, not the lookout, but the men who are arguing with the lookout, with toxic fumes. The men inside are tired, they are choking on smoke, and they just want to go home. But the lookout, however, the lookout has other plans. The lookout urges them on as Rollins keeps recording. And what Rollins doesn't know, although he is starting to suspect, is that he's recording one of Britain's most notorious bank heists as it unfolds.
And what's this heist called?
The Baker Street Heist.
Featuring Joe Sweeney from Thinking Sideways Podcast and filmmaker Vincent Caldoni, this is The Shocking Details.
You ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
The Baker Street burglary is basically the biggest, most notorious, and most successful bank heist in UK history. At least one of the most successful.
Just about, like...
And, so successful, so notorious, that they actually made a movie about it. But we'll tell you more about that later. The burglars managed to pull it off without setting off any alarms, without drawing a single gun. And if not for Robert Rollins, they would have pulled off this whole huge, amazing heist without a single hitch, and would have made off with something like 3 million pounds, which is about roughly 30 million pounds today, same about $42 million in American bucks.
That's a good bank robbery.
Yeah. Man. Some estimates go as high as 70 million pounds, or that would be roughly 97 million bucks.
That's in today's money.
Today's money. Yeah. Which puts them way up there in some rare company among bank heists. And because this was actually a ripoff of safe deposit boxes. And mm-hmm. I know I'm familiar with another one of the heists that I was talking about earlier. It's a similar thing. The robbers, and this took place in a whole nother country, a whole nother hemisphere. But officially they got away with X amount of money, quite a lot, but unofficially they got away with many times more than that because they were in a country where people just preferred not to let the government know how much money they had for obvious reasons. And so a lot of people kept a lot of stuff stashed in their bank deposit box. And so that's probably what was going on here. They probably got away with a vast amount of money and gold and all kinds of good stuff. But they might have gotten something even better than just gold and cash. They might have actually walked away with some really juicy blackmail material regarding the royal family. Doesn't get much better than that. That is a ticket to either, you know, vast wealth or maybe assassination. But yeah, it's a ticket to something.
They also, these guys, we already brought up Heistapalooza, these guys also may have inspired the Burrowing Bandits. I think that's...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember we talked about the Burrowing Bandits last when we did Heistapalooza.
Yep. Yeah, because they had a similar methodology. Mm-hmm. And like the Burrowing Bandits, they broke into safe deposit boxes, so... We don't know all what was in those boxes.
Mm-hmm.
We can only just sort of try to guess at the estimated value.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Joe, why don't you tell us about the mastermind of this whole operation?
Anthony, a.k.a. Tony Gavin, was 38 years old, a career criminal, adventurer. He formerly taught hand-to-hand combat for the Army. Mm-hmm. Also a photographer and considered to be a ladies' man. And he was played by a certain actor in a certain movie, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah, exactly.
You know the actor, though.
Oh, I know the actor.
Yeah, Gavin, it turns out, he had this one little quirk, which I find really awesome. He was a huge Sherlock Holmes fan. I suspect he was really kind of a Moriarty guy rather than a Holmes or a Watson guy. But
exactly.
But he was inspired by the story, The Red-Headed League, which is a great Holmes story. I love the way Holmes solves it quite quickly. He figures it out just like zip, which he tended to do the way we do. And in this particular one, Holmes and Watson attempt to bust a gang of burglars who are tunneling into a bank vault.
Ah,
yeah. But they get onto it by, you know, the way they get onto it. If you're not familiar with the story, it's a good story.
It's a great, it's one of the good, if you like the Holmes shorts, it's a really great one. It's certainly in my top five mm-hmm. Holmes short stories.
Yeah. It is a good one. It's one of the more memorable ones. Tony Gavin decided that his little bank heist would hit Lloyd's Bank Lloyd's Bank of London, not the same Lloyd's of London that you usually hear about, but he chose a branch of the bank located on Baker Street. Yeah. Because of course, the same Baker Street that Sherlock Holmes lived on.
Yeah. This must have been so perfect for Gavin.
I'm sure it sweetened the deal for him hugely. Yeah. But it wasn't just because it was on Baker Street. Also, many of London's most wealthy and powerful families did their banking there.
Yeah.
So it would be the place to hit. But of course, being the place to hit means security is ultra, ultra high, right?
You would hope.
You would hope. So yeah, they found a clever way around that apparently, but we'll talk about that later.
We will talk about it. So Gavin enlisted the help of Reginald Tucker, who was a friend of his who had no criminal record. He was a businessman. And in December 1970, Tucker opened a bank account at Lloyd's Bank, branch on Baker Street, depositing just 500 pounds. So that's not all that much, but it's enough to get him in the door.
Oh, of course.
And that same February, or the next February, I should say, Tucker returned to the bank and rented a safe deposit box. Over the months, Tucker went back to the box at least 13 times, but he was not there to check on his precious goods.
Mm. Why was he there?
Well, okay. So back in the 70s, bank staff would open the boxes for the renters, but they wouldn't hang out, you know, as the customer did whatever they needed to do, put stuff in the box, take stuff out.
Yeah, actually, they still do that today, as far as I know. I mean, I have a safe deposit box, although I had one. I let it go, but, you know, they would always open up the box and just leave the room and say, okay, let me know when you want to close it back up. Yeah.
So I was trying to find this out. This seems like this is not policy in London right now.
Oh, really?
They'll give you some, what it seems like, and listeners in the UK, feel free to get back to me. I don't know if it's just Lloyd's, but from what I could gather, they do stay in the room with you. They don't look at what you're doing.
Maybe they go off to the corner and just sort of like, you know,
yeah,
they can't really but see it, what you're up to.
I know specifically that Lloyd's changed their policy on this directly because of this case.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
They don't leave you in the room alone with everybody else's safe deposit box.
And but Tucker, of course, wasn't doing any B&E at all when he was in that vault.
No. So what he was there to do is he was there to get a measurement. He was there to map out the joint. And he wanted to get the exact specs. So what Tucker was able to do was to draw a perfect layout and measure the room using his umbrella as a yardstick.
Uh-huh.
He also used the floor tiles as a size for reference.
Clever. So at this point, Tony Gavin brings in some more friends on the job. He brought in a shady used car salesman named Thomas Stevens. That's a pretty sketchy name.
Sounds like a made-up name, but yeah. He's English, so I guess.
Yeah. So from him, he would get the tools that they would need, including a 100-ton jack and a thermal lance, which is made to melt steel. That's kind of cool. I want to get one, actually.
Yeah, I know. I looked one up. I was like, oh, that's pretty badass.
Yeah. I think that I could see a use for that. Yeah. Some others were brought in the job, including at least one explosives expert. Yeah, that makes sense. An alarm expert. And a couple of others, but these guys were not identified. But we sort of have an outline of the gang here. It sounds like a kind of a classic heist movie kind of cast, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this doesn't just feel like this is Ocean's 11 or something?
Oh, yeah. Totally. Got the explosives guy, got the alarm guy. You know, I mean, yeah. So this is cool. I like it.
So Lloyd's Bank was situated at 187 Baker Street.
Not too far down the door from Sherlock's place.
No, right. Yeah, you're really in the same neighborhood. But our burglars... they began their business at number 189, which had once been a leather goods store called Le Sac.
It's a weird name for a leather goods store. I don't know. No wonder they went out of business.
it's interesting. I don't know what they sold. I tried to actually find out some information on Le Sac, but they had just recently went out of business. Tony's pal, this guy Benjamin Wolf, who was already like a shop owner, did real estate and stuff. He took over the lease and. That was $10,000 a month.
£10,000
a month. That's even more.
Yeah.
That's like $13,000 in 1970 money.
Yeah. That's a little bit of upfront money for this heist.
Right. Yeah. So this is a really upscale neighborhood. It is even today.
Well, luckily he got the run of the whole building though, right? For his rent.
So the lease wasn't just for 189 Baker Street. It was for the whole building. Which includes the basement.
The basement. Kind of key. One of our burglars had a contact with a staff member working for the Lloyd's Bank security system. That's key. And our unnamed contact informed them that the road construction happening nearby had caused some false alarms within the bank. So because of this, the alarm in the vault's floor had been shut off. Now that's handy.
So, right. I mean, that's pretty smart.
That is really handy. Everything kind of came together for these guys in a nice way. And so in August of 1971, they got to work. They began to dig a tunnel from the basement of the former Le Sac store, passing underneath the Chicken Inn restaurant that was in between their building and the bank. It was only about 40 feet, but they had to dig through a lot of earth and concrete. So it was a major undertaking.
Yeah.
And God knows, I mean, London has been around for many centuries. God knows what kind of crap they found. They might have actually dug through some important archaeological finds and just basically,
that can happen in London.
I don't really know.
What I do know is that this was a really physically intense process.
Oh, yeah.
The dig took place only on weekends so that shopkeepers and restaurant patrons and bank employees wouldn't hear them digging. And eventually the group dug into the basement of the Chicken Inn where they actually used the foundation of the restaurant as a roof for their tunnel.
Mm-hmm. Pretty cool. Now by reached the basement, you mean they reached the basement and went underneath it, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was not able to figure out if there's actually a proper basement to the Chicken Inn. I could not get that information, but whatever was the bottom of the Chicken Inn, whether it was a basement, as I suspect, or whether it didn't have a basement, but it was just the structure.
Foundation.
This was helpful to them because if you think about it, one of the big things when you dig a tunnel is you don't want the tunnel to collapse on you.
Yeah, exactly.
And they set it up so that the buildings were actually forming the roof of the tunnel, which takes a lot of the engineering difficulty of building a tunnel off of them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, so that was fortuitous. Thanks, Chicken Inn.
Yeah, Chicken Inn helped them out. I'd be curious to know if these guys would really have been able to pull this off, because I don't know if any of them had any engineering experience.
Mm-hmm.
And a 40-foot tunnel, it sounds well and good until the roof falls in.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one of those things that actually you don't really need a lot of engineering experience. All you do is over-engineer it, but that in itself is problematical, because you got to bring in tons and tons of rebar and concrete or tons and tons of lumber, you know, and things like that, and you just over-engineer it.
It'll come up a lot, but the burrowing bandits kind of did the exact same thing.
Yeah.
In that they let the city dig the tunnels for them, and then they just dug out of the tunnels and into the bank.
Yeah.
Because right? It was the sewage system that they were using.
In this case, you know, they were generating quite a lot of dirt. What did they do with the dirt?
They just piled it up in the basement of LaSac, the building at 189. And when that was full or nearly full, they just dumped it in the alley out back of the building.
Wow, that is not good tradecraft. But apparently nobody noticed, so all's well that ends well, I guess.
They were new tenants in the building, so it maybe wouldn't be too surprising they were doing some kind of work, and it might, whatever, I don't know.
Yeah.
But the tunnel generated 17,920 pounds of waste, at least. Honestly, it seems like it was probably more than that. So that's a lot of dirt they were moving.
Hell of a lot of dirt. And of course, you know the rule about dirt, too. It's packed dirt. You dig it up. It fluffs up to a volume about 3 to 4 times the original volume of the dirt that you're digging up, you know? And so, yeah, that's a lot of dirt.
A lot of dirt. It's a lot of dirt.
Yeah.
Over the course of the digging, Gavin lost 28 pounds, at least. I've heard it upwards of 30, but yeah, at least 28 pounds. So once the group reached the bank, they still had to dig 15 feet up. Like up through the dirt to get to the floor of the bank's vault.
Well, I bet that was a joy. Every time you stab your shovel into the dirt and you get some dirt in the face. What fun.
I mean, I've never really honestly done this, but like digging up has got to be a real challenge, because you're dropping the load that you're trying to clear down onto your head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
While you're doing it.
Yeah. And it'd probably be tense too, because you don't know if you're going to get a shovel full of dirt in your face, or if you're going to get like, you know, a half ton of dirt in the face. You don't
or really, a rock.
Or a big rock. Yeah.
You just hit a rock and then it falls down on your head. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't really know. I wish there was more details that I could find about like what this looked like, how they engineered this, but it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And by September 10th, the tunnel was complete. Gavin and his gang were just 3 feet away from the interior of the vault.
Unfortunately, that's 3 feet of concrete, right?
Solid concrete. So this is not like, and it's hard to describe it, like this is really powerful stuff. I believe it was rebar reinforced.
You would think
this was going to be hard to get through. I think that's what the thermal lance was for, though. I have not heard definitely that the concrete had rebar in it. I would imagine it did. Most banks do.
Yeah.
So they put a lookout on the roof above the bank, you know, just to watch out for anybody coming by.
Good idea.
These walkie-talkies to communicate with Gavin and all the others, some of whom were in different places.
That's a great idea, because nobody ever listens in on walkie-talkie conversations. But oh wait.
Well, okay, it's 1971. It's a little less common, and
yeah,
I could not figure this out, because some of the stuff has just not been made public. But using walkie-talkies through my own work, if your walkie-talkie intrudes on an FM broadcast channel, you are not on approved walkie-talkie frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
So my guess is they were further hiding their actions by using some kind of off-brand frequency. They were outside the normal range, or doing something they weren't supposed to with those old walkies, which you could do back in the day.
Yeah, just slap. I don't know if this is that far back in the day. It used to be way back in the day that you to change frequencies, you had to change the crystals in your radio. That's like way back in the day.
But, wow, yeah, it would be a long time ago.
Yeah, not that long ago, actually. But yeah, the radios have come a long way. Besides the walkie-talkies, we've got this concrete to deal with. So Tony Gavin had hoped to use the thermal lance to break through the vault floor. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. A lot of heat and fumes filled the tunnel. This is something I think that Roland's actually captured his recordings with these guys. Talking about.
Yeah, they were not
how bad the job was. So everybody was choking on that. Apparently, they didn't think to bring respirators, gas masks, and stuff like that. And so finally, they gave up on the thermal lance. Nice idea, but maybe next job. They they decided to use explosives instead. Mm-hmm. So success. Although that would be scary. 3 feet of concrete. How much explosives would you have to use?
I wish I could have got more about how they did this. I believe what they would have done is drilled a series of, pilot holes and mm-hmm. stuffed explosives into there.
Yeah.
I didn't find out how they did it, but
No, I mean, you can't just put a box of dynamite up against the bottom of the floor and secure it with some duct tape and light the fuse. That's probably not going to do you much good.
Yeah. I also wanted to figure out what type of charges they used. Did they use shape charges but that stuff that the British government's squatting on that information. And I don't think I'm going to know about that anytime soon.
They do tend to be secretive, those guys.
But whatever it is they used or however they did it, they got in. It was a success.
Yes.
Walkie-talkie sprung to life. The gang went out and informed their lookout, but it turns out somebody else was listening. That's Robert Rollins.
Robert Rollins. What a snitch.
He's kind of a badass. Rollins.
He's cool, but if it had been me, I would have gone down and walked around until the signal got as strong as it could and realized, okay, this is the bank. Then knock at the door, say, hey, guys, can I have a cut? Mm-hmm. And I mm-hmm. probably would have been murdered, but that's
probably.
But speaking of Rollins, so he realized that what he was hearing was a bank robbery in progress, as he'd been listening for a while now. And there were only so many banks in the area that he could be listening in on, again, because of that range issue. So he calls Scotland Yard. Since the local police weren't interested, he thought maybe Scotland Yard would be. And they were interested, after all. They marshaled a lot of local officers to check 750 banks. They decided to draw a circle 10 miles in radius. Within 10 miles of Rollins' home. Within that circle, there were 750 banks. They sent policemen to check every one of them. Which is, yeah. So this is early Sunday morning. Tony Gavin and his gang are inside the vault, they're unloading safe deposit boxes. While they were there, the police came calling. They arrived mm-hmm. at the bank, and they were actually in the building at the same time. And
this is so wild.
Yeah, I know. The lookout sounded the alarm over the walkie-talkies, but appears to have been too late. But the cops, on the other hand, saw nothing suspicious. The vault was locked tightly and had a time lock on it. It had one of those timer locks, so you couldn't just mm-hmm. open it any time of the day. And it obviously had not been tampered with. And so they just turned around and left with the lookout surprise. And I'm sure elation is he thought it was the end. They were totally busted. And the cops just it looks all good. So they left. Mm-hmm. So the gang continued.
Wild. Oh, no, they're just so wild that there was just a beefy piece of steel, but just a single piece of steel separating them from Scotland Yard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. And I'm sure the cops were kicking themselves. I'm sure the press had fun making fun of them for this whole thing. But meantime, our gang continued with their work. They busted into a total of 270 safe deposit boxes before they finally left. And then Monday morning rolls around, the bank opens, and the bank staff realized that they had indeed been burglarized.
In the moment, it was estimated the bandits got away with about 1.5 million pounds in cash. That's about 2 million, plus another 1.5 million in valuables were also stolen.
Yeah.
However, just like the burrowing bandits, we're going to bring them up a lot, exactly what was taken has never been calculated.
Yeah.
So just as in LA, in that case, the powerful clients who rented the security boxes had done so because of the level of secrecy that Lloyd's promised them.
Yeah.
Remember that last little tidbit, because that part is going to come back in a pretty huge way.
Yeah.
And the police, they did find one weird little written clue right on the wall of the bank's vault. It said, "Let's see how Sherlock Holmes solves this one." It was clearly a taunt to the police. And I mean, it has to be Tony Gavin.
Right? Well, he's violating my rule of criming criminality, which is never taunt the police.
But just don't.
Yeah. If you don't taunt them, if you respect them, then they won't be as motivated to come and find you. But the heist was huge news, not just with the police, but with the public as well. And of course, the public, when they heard the news of it, began to do the same kind of things we do, which is theorize and hypothesize. Mm-hmm. And there was a popular theory that the bank heist was just a cover for something more nefarious, possibly a conspiracy that might lead right up to the gates of Buckingham Palace. With all this rampant speculation going on, everybody's having a good time. And then suddenly this thing called a D notice came down.
This is one of the wilder, one more interesting to me. I guess not wild, but just interesting aspects.
Yeah.
So with basically no explanation, the British government issued what is known as, or was known, it doesn't exist anymore, it was called at the time a D-notice, forcing every news outlet to end their coverage. Now, D-notices were only issued in instances that have something to do with national security.
Yeah.
This isn't national security, but this is a bank got broke. And apparently the wording behind the D-notice was so vague that nobody actually at the time or now knew what it meant or why it was issued. And
yeah,
that really only served to inflame public speculation.
Yeah, it's a little shocking that they would do that because it really only makes the whole situation worse. Like you say, I mean, if you're really worried about, if this speculation about Buckingham Palace, it just comes up and then the D-notice comes down, it's kind of the same. You're kind of basically confirming the theory, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, that's how it looks.
It kind of looks that way anyway.
So, also, from what I understand, D-notices were not like a really common
thing, no,
especially in the 70s. It was more like a World War II kind of thing.
Yeah. So this is bizarre, but speculation returned to the royal family, and it especially centered on Queen Elizabeth's sister, Princess Margaret. Yeah, she had been known for controversy. Or I should say controversy.
Controversy.
Say it the right way. She was rumored to have had extramarital affairs. And many of these rumors were supposedly proven by love letters leaked to the press. And there were some other rumors, like she had a supposedly fling with Mick Jagger. That is unproven. As far as I know, Mick has not said anything one way or the other about it.
Yeah, but Mick, if you want to come on the podcast and talk about it, we're here for you, buddy.
Yeah, we know. Yeah, Mick's still out there. Actually, he just released a song, believe it or not.
Did he?
He did.
Oh, man. So Princess Margaret, she really liked to go on these Caribbean vacations. And her friends, they brought their cameras with them.
Ooh.
Years after the Lloyd's heist, one of these photos would be published showing that the princess had dated a gardener, a groundskeeper, who was 17 years her junior. Muy escandalosa. And rumors persisted that there were even more sensational photos of the princess's secret life out there somewhere. But the question is, who would be behind these leaks?
That is a good question.
You're right, because we never know. We don't know to this day who would leak them. A lot of people pointed the finger at a guy named Michael X, who was described in the papers at the time as a Trinidadian black radical.
Hmm.
And guess who had a safe deposit box at Lloyd's on Baker Street?
Mm-hmm.
Michael X. Yeah. He'd also been one of the victims of the heist.
Yeah.
And so why does a civil rights activist from Trinidad across the ocean have a safe deposit box in the heart of London? That's a little odd and in a really rich place.
Yeah, that is a little odd.
The rumor was that Princess Margaret had been carrying on this affair with this prominent gangster. And that Michael X had gotten the pics to prove it, and he intended to blackmail the royal family.
Yeah, and then, of course, the royal family struck back by basically hiring some guys to break into the bank.
Yeah, see, I don't know. We'll talk about that in theories. There's all kinds of ways this could have shook out. Yeah,
I find this theory has been out there for a long time, and it's plausible. It's very plausible.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure that I would have done the tunnel thing. I probably would have done something else. I don't know what. I'm going to have to think about how else I could have pulled that off. I'll come out next week. I'll let you know what I'm thinking here. But back to our story. Now, when you compare the cash haul and the slick setup and the execution, you'd imagine these guys were much better than, say, the burring bandits of L.A. But not entirely the case. I mean, these guys they did a reasonably competent job of breaking into the bank, and they actually did a reasonably good job of gathering intel, which is key to this kind of thing.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, they were stupid. They were careless.
So careless.
Yes. Yeah, so, some people might say suspiciously so. The police found the tunnel, of course. They traced it underground quite easily back to the leather store. Which is where they found the thermal lance, the walkie-talkies, other tools, including a torch. They apparently bagged up 800 pieces of evidence, and it was all, of course, forensically examined. But here's the thing that's remarkably dumb is that Wolf, the guy who leased the Lissac, property, he leased it under his own name.
I mean, that's...
Are you kidding?
That's so crazy. That he was so dumb.
You know, seriously, that's just... So So we got a contrast here, and this will fuel some speculation here. How is it that these guys, so freaking dumb, so unsophisticated, were able to actually plan this out and gather the really important intel needed to pull off this amazing job? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I can't wonder why people are speculating.
Yeah,
and police, of course, were able to track down Wolf fairly easily, and of course, the rest of the gang, or most of the rest of the gang,
at all,
were, you know, easily connected to Wolf. Mm. But that was not the end of the speculation. Scotland Yard also thought that during the burglary that there was a woman on the walkie-talkies. They thought that she was acting as a controller.
Which is pretty interesting.
Right? Yeah.
It seems like Tony Gavin was kind of the ringleader, but this woman, they called her Little Legs, was calling the shots. She seemed like she was maybe not necessarily in charge, but she was giving orders.
Yeah, I think that you could see it. I think Tony Gavin was kind of the foreman of the gang. He was like
the foreman of
the gang, but he wasn't actually the CEO in charge of the company. Yeah,
no, I think that's a good way to put it. That's definitely how, if you go on the internet, you can see there are interviews. Rollins is still alive. He's quite old, but he's recently started giving interviews about what he heard. Because I don't think you can listen to the tapes. I worked really hard to try and hear the tapes, and mm-hmm. I could not.
Well, you know, if they slapped a D notice on everything, I'm sure the tapes got confiscated.
I think he willingly handed them over.
Probably, but he at some point said, hey, you know, if you're done with them, can I have the tapes back? And they said, screw you, pal.
Yes, yeah. You think? No, exactly. Yeah. There's not actually FOIA. There's not really an equivalent to FOIA in Britain.
Yeah. So
if that's evidence, they can keep it. But yeah, Rollins has talked about it. He really felt that the woman was kind of in charge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It all was kind of head scratching.
It is a little weird.
Yeah, it is. It is.
So that October, surveillance team saw Tucker. Remember, he was one of the first guys in on this project.
Yeah.
Hand over a bag to two men, Abdullah Hashan Gangji and his nephew, Akbar Muhammad Ali Gangji. And the two were arrested with 32,000 pounds and all seized, of course.
Yeah.
And it was connected directly back to the Lloyds heist. I don't know exactly how. They knew that that money had come from that specific heist.
Hmm. Okay.
And then it was really very shortly after that Wolf, Gavins, Stevens, and Tucker were all arrested, and the police recovered an additional 231,000 pounds in banknotes and other valuables that were identified as being taken from the vaults themselves.
It's so sad when you see a smooth heist like this go all to hell at the end, you know?
Well, it's such a fascinating story because they seem so organized, and yet their follow through, from what I can gather about the Gangji uncle and nephew team, these guys were low level crooks. These were not the kind of people, if you'd spent that much time, energy, money, and thought planning a heist like this, I don't think the Gangjis would be the guys you'd run to defense.
No, I had no idea. Was it supposed to launder this money for them? Was that the plan? Give them a little walking around money?
They were, so near as I can tell, the Gangjis, and I don't know all the stuff about it, like all the circumstance around it, the Gangjis were going to get the money out of the country for them and then take a cut of it.
I don't really deposit it
in a bank in the Cayman Islands or what the hell ever, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think I would have just taken all the money down to the coast and bought myself a boat or rented one.
sailed to France or something. I don't know. Yeah.
Rather than hand over huge quantities of money to some sketchy characters. That's how
who were already on the police's radar, and they were, I don't know, but nothing I've read, I don't want to be too judgmental of these men. I don't know anything about them, but everything I've read is like, yeah, these are not the most sophisticated guys to try to move money out of the country.
So back to our investigation, the other aspect, Lloyd's provided the police with the names of 260 safety deposit box owners. Eight others refused to allow their names to be released to police. So they just basically were willing to take the hit, and they didn't want the police to know anything about them. So I know, right?
That's so weird.
I mean, right?
It'd be one thing to say, well, you know, we're sorry, officer, but we actually didn't have anything we're worried about in that box, and we don't want to get involved. But it's another thing to be like, to ask the bank, do not tell them that box was in my name.
Yeah, that's what they did. I mean, there was, I don't know. Whatever the reason, but Lloyd's respected their privacy, and apparently I don't think that the police had any way to force them to turn the names over.
I guess not.
Yeah. A lot of what we know about the contents of the boxes was based on insurance claims, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, of course, if there's stuff in there you can't really declare on your insurance, well,
yeah,
that doesn't get noted. So that's why, you know, I'm very sure there was plenty of stuff that was not reported. and
yeah,
including some naked pictures of the princess.
That is,
how do you file an insurance claim on that? How do you set a value on that? Oh my God.
Right. Well, so it makes you wonder what of those 8 boxes, what was in there? I mean, even if it had nothing to do with
it or
whatever, like, what did they have in there that they just didn't even want the police knowing their name?
Oh, I know. I know.
Much less saying, I'm not filing an insurance claim. I don't want to have anything to do with this investigation. I don't care that it was stolen. But then they say, I don't even want my name going to the police. I don't want them to even know I had a safety deposit box at this bank.
I
wonder if there's something sketchy
in, there, to, right?
in one of those 8.
I'm trying to imagine if Michael X, who supposedly possessed all this blackmail material on the princess, and he files an insurance claim and decides to claim it was worth, like, say, 10 million pounds, you know, and the insurance adjuster's got to, like, you know, got to figure out, well, is that a reasonable amount? So in doing his appraisal of the value of the photos, he has to call the royal family. Say basically, well, okay.
Would you have given me?
Supposing I've got some naked pornographic pictures of the princess. What would you pay for that? And maybe call a few other royal families across Europe and just say, okay, what would you pay? And just call around, you know, and just sort of get an estimate.
So we don't know what was in Michael X's box.
No, we don't.
If Scotland Yard ever figured it out, if they knew. They've never said. We'll get into what happened to Michael X, but he went to his grave and he never told me.
Well, we don't really know that it was. It could have been some blackmail on the princess, but it could have been some other stuff that actually did have to do with national security. This guy was actually, you know, a revolutionary, a troublemaker, or whatever. Maybe MI5, or to name one possible person or group of people that would want to know what the contents of that box would be. You know, maybe they really wanted to see what was inside that safe deposit. And so, you know, so it might not have been pictures of the princess that really motivated this.
No, it's true. Yeah. I mean, the Princess Margaret thing has been moving in the last years, really in the last like 5-6 years has been, and we'll talk about it in theories, has been moving closer and closer to being confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know that for sure. We don't know what was there. And honestly, the Michael X thing, we'll talk about this. We're getting close to theories, but we'll talk about this in theories. The Michael X thing could just be a whole crazy red herring. Oh, yeah. We don't know. Obviously, like, so one interesting thing is Michael X was clearly not one of the 8 people who didn't get named.
Yeah.
Because we know, right, we're talking about him. We know he had a safe deposit box there.
Yeah.
But there's some other weird stuff. So Lloyd's provided the police with the 8 people, right? With the 260 plus the 8 who wouldn't go forward.
Yeah.
But there's this other weird stuff, right? So the men captured had known connection to gang members, and none except Gavin really had like criminal records. And Gavin had done some crime, but he was nobody's vision of a master bank robber.
Yeah.
Also adding to these conspiracy theories that were floating around Britain in the 70s is that Scotland Yard considered prosecuting Rollins under the wireless
telegraphy.
The Wireless Telegraphy Act of 1967 for listening to unlicensed transmission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
fortunately, they didn't do it. But what?
Well, I know that's I don't know how they could prosecute somebody, because if something goes out over the radio wave, then, you know, anybody can listen in. But then they're saying unlicensed, so they're saying you're supposed to know somehow that this was not a licensed transmission.
Yeah,
and therefore you don't get.
As I understand it. I looked this up, and I'm not a scholar on this. I didn't have the time I would like to get into the Wireless Telegraphy Act of 1967, but it was to make it a crime to listen to basically things like pirate radio,
mm-hmm.
or possibly transmissions by a foreign government would be another example that could be used for.
Or maybe
it
just
was
private,
not designed.
Yeah, maybe private conversations. Maybe it was obvious this was a private conversation he was eavesdropping on. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, except for I don't think they were supposed to be broadcasting on that frequency. If you're a radio expert and you want to tell me about how I'm wrong about that, please do. I'm not super knowledgeable at how radios work. But even that, though, I don't think he was doing anything illegal. And even if he was, the first thing he did was call the police. Like, he was cooperating.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying his hardest as a private citizen to prevent or stop in progress one of the biggest bank heists, arguably the biggest bank heist in the history of the UK.
Yeah.
And then they wanted to prosecute him for that?
No,
I don't think that. I don't know much about Scotland Yard, but like, that's not what the FBI would do here.
Well, like, if it's not. It'd be bad PR. Although, you know, all we know is that there was
just a jerk move.
Well, what we know is this. I mean, it was reported that they considered prosecuting. Hmm. And this report was reported by the press, probably on the basis of a leak. And so, you know, truthfully, if somebody might have just sort of jokingly said, "Hey, why don't we throw this guy in jail for eavesdropping?" No, you know, I mean, who knows exactly how much they considered it? You know, I don't know. I really don't know why. I mean, it makes no sense.
Right.
But anyway,
you know that Lloyd's did not agree with Scotland Yard on this.
No,
they sent him a check for £2,500 to thank him for trying to intervene.
I know, classy move on the part of old Lloyd's Bank, and of course, yeah. You know, of course, the government probably confiscated the check, but they confiscated a little bit with taxation, of course.
You know, they did. That's all windfall.
Yeah. So how it all shook out for our gang members. So Gavin and Tucker and Stevens all pleaded guilty, and they spent 12 years in the pokey.
Yep.
Wolf, on the other hand, fought the charges, pled not guilty. He wound up getting only 8 years. Lucky guy.
Yeah.
And the police, of course, suspected that others were involved in the robbery, including the mystery woman that Rollins heard on the radio.
So Scotland Yard released, I'll put it up there, they released this kind of like visual map mm-hmm. of who they thought were involved. And they make it pretty clear from this, based on what they heard on the tape that Rollins made and their investigation, that there has to be at least two people who were not caught.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all. Well, anyway, it was good of Tony and the gang to not roll over on their buddies.
They didn't. Yeah, and I mean, I guess I don't know. I'd like to think they were asked.
Oh, lately. I'm sure they
were. Tell us who else was involved.
I'm sure they were. But yeah, but they didn't. They were stand up guys. But there's still a lot of questions. Our guys got busted. We know who they were, at least, you know, 2/3 of them. But there's still a lot of questions out there, which is why did the local police not respond initially to Rollins when he called them up and said, "Hey, I'm hearing a robbery in progress."
Why? Right.
Yeah. And also, you know, when the Scotland Yard decided to check it out, they checked banks within a 10-mile radius of Rollins' house, even though he told them he could only pick up a broadcast within maybe a mile radius. And yet they decided to
go. For him, apparently, like, again, I just don't understand radio engineering as well as I wish I did. But for him to pick that up with his antenna, it had to be within about a mile of his flat in a circle.
Yeah, because I mean, your average walkie-talkie, frankly, does not have a great reach. And in an urban environment with a lot of metal and buildings and stuff like that around,
it's a really dense part of London.
Yeah, it really reduces the reach even more. So and so that's another strange one. Yeah, it's almost as if the police really didn't want to know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, Rollins. I think it's BBC. One of the stations in the UK did an interview with Rollins in the last few years, and he's like, "Yeah, they all but hung up on me."
Yeah, yeah. Who knows? I mean, and it could have been that maybe that's standard operating procedure, or maybe MI5 called him and said, "Hey guys, we're going to be doing a little B&E in this weekend, and so we'd prefer if you guys just sort of take your sweet time responding to any phone calls you might get." Mm-hmm. So, but some other unanswered questions. The burglars are on record as saying that they were hang on a second. Over this a little bit. That they were in afraid of the fumes. Does that mean that they were afraid of the fumes, or?
Yeah, that basically they were choking to death on the fumes.
Yeah.
They were afraid for their life. Sorry, in afraid of fumes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so the burglars were on record as saying that they were afraid of the fumes that the thermal lance was creating and that it smelled horribly and strongly. Yeah. Then they used high-powered explosives to blast out the floor of the vault. And minutes after this whole thing happens, the cops entered the bank and didn't notice anything. They didn't smell anything. I mean, I'm not sure. Maybe the vault was, like, you know, sealed. And maybe that was it. I don't know.
I think it is completely within the realm of possibility that the vault was sealed so tightly that the fumes couldn't escape and the cop just didn't smell or notice anything. I'm just really curious. Smoking the place up, they're lighting off explosives. That cop didn't notice a thing?
Apparently not. Anything? I guess not.
I mean, I don't know. It is weird. Like, I'm not saying that's like definitely that cop came in, knew what was going on at that bank, and then walked back out because he was on the take or whatever, but that's odd.
Yeah, a little bit.
It's worth remembering when you think of theories about this.
Mm-hmm. And we got a few other questions besides.
Well, one of my big questions is about the D notice.
That's a good one. That is, that's a really interesting question.
Right. I mean, a few thugs ripping off a bank, that's not national security unless it was.
Right. National security or the royal family, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, another question, why did the cops totally give up the hunt for the additional suspects?
Yeah, I'm not sure that Scotland Yard would have agreed with my categorization there, but there doesn't seem to have been any real attempt to find the two other guys they said were involved.
Yeah, they didn't find those guys, and they also didn't find the bulk of the loot.
Yeah, that's true.
And so, yeah, that's good, because, you know, when those guys got out of prison, they needed something to retire on.
Yeah. Well, you'd wonder where it went, right? Like, even if they don't have it, even if they're just now stand up law abiding citizens out there, or if they've passed away, where is it? Who has it?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe it actually got stolen and squirreled away somewhere. And then the guy that squirreled it away got run over by a bus, and it's just out there waiting to be found. Wouldn't that be cool?
That's kind of my main questions about it.
Yeah.
Do you have any additional questions about this?
No, not right at the top. I think that, you know, the speculation, of course, is fun, really fun and intriguing about the princess. And
well, we're going to get into that. That's going to be part two of this episode.
And you're going to want to tune back in for the second part of this, because some of the theories behind this thing are really kind of fascinating. I think it's not just.
I also want to put out there that this mystery does not stop in 1971. We're going to keep going basically right up to the present day.
Yeah, it actually keeps busting into the headlines every now and again in Britain.
Yeah,
it does. Yeah, it's a great story. So stay tuned for some vital information on reaching us via email and social media, and of course, you know, the usual plea to leave us a rating and a review.
Really helps people find the podcast, helps us grow the podcast. We keep doing this.
Yeah.
We've gotten some amazing reviews from you guys. They make us really happy when we read them.
It does. It does. We really like to know that people are listening and that they like what we're doing.
You know? Well, yeah. And then the other crazy thing is I get to see the statistics. And so when you guys go out and leave us reviews and you know, ratings, we see our numbers start to climb a little. And that it's like such a big help to us in trying to make this podcast be a thing that sticks around, that can be in your ear holes every week. Please give us a good rating, review, and all that stuff.
That's right. If you don't do this, then we will eventually just become homeless, and we won't be able to do this again anymore. And, you know, what will you do with
eventually
your life
then? This feed will just be me discussing movies from the 1930s.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah.
No one wants it.
So rating, review. All right, folks. So until next time. Signing off.
The Shocking Details can be found at www.theshockingdetails.com. We're on Twitter at Shocking Details. For discussion of episodes and more, our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/shockingdetailspodcast/. Or you can email us at theshockingdetailspodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider giving us a like and a positive review and letting people know about us.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.